Often when I prepare to preach, I'm reminded that we all have a job to do this morning. I have some ideas that I want to get across. I want you to get them. I think one thing that would help us both to do our jobs well would be if we both read through the passage before we came to church. On our website, the passage is always listed in the bulletin the week before, so you always know, we always know what is going to be taught the next Sunday. So we put that information there for you, for your benefit. So that might be something moving into the fall if you don't already do it. I know some of you do, and I think that's a great idea. Take 10, 15, 20 minutes and just read through the passage and think about what it might mean, and maybe bring a question to the service each week. And if you don't think the question got answered, or if you're not happy with the question that was offered, come and speak to the speaker and tell him that, you know, I've been reading this passage this week too, so we're in this together. That's just by way of suggestion. Well, today is a Psalm 77 kind of day. You may recall when email did not yet exist. Some of us divide our lives by before email and then after email. Some time ago, I got an email from a friend of mine, and at the bottom of the email was just this little cryptic note. And he said, it's been a Psalm 77 kind of day, kind of week. Let me give you the backstory. My friend Richard was unemployed at the time, and he had a pretty specific skill set. He was well-trained. I think he was competent, and he wanted to stay in his field of work. Fair enough. And so he kept his ear to the ground, and whenever he got a lead, he'd follow it up. Got an email, he'd respond to it. Put out his resumes. Some of you have been there. Some of you, it's a distant memory. You can't remember not having a job. Some of you might even wish you'd get a new job. But, you know, every time he heard of an opportunity, he'd put his resume out there, and then he would do the interviews. And nothing. Nothing, nothing. For a year, nothing. Well, you know, you may realize that an unemployed man is not a happy man. And Richard was really feeling bummed out about this. It seemed to him like his life was sort of circling the drain. You been there? I've had that feeling. You may have had that experience too. That's how he's feeling. He's pretty bummed out. Wherever he goes, it's like there's this cloud over Richard's head. And he and I would get together from time to time. It got to the point where I really didn't have a lot of wisdom for him anymore. I felt like I've sort of exhausted my wisdom, and I would leave our times together feeling a little bummed out myself. And Richard said to me one day, he said, you know, I pray and I call out to God, and it's, I don't think my prayers are getting any higher than the ceiling. He was really frustrated. He was a man of faith. He believed in God. He believed in prayer, but he just didn't seem to be getting the results that he was looking for. Today we want to look at Psalm 77. Richard sent that note to me. He said, I'm having a Psalm 77 kind of day. Because it's a story about another man whose name was not Richard. It was a man whose name was Asaph. Asaph was a worship leader. His name started with an A. Anybody here know a song leader whose name starts with the letter A? A? Asaph was actually sort of a little bit higher up in the hierarchy, and he was one of the chief musicians in the reign of David, during the time when David reigned. And he was a godly man, and he was a gifted man. And he had learned to think big thoughts about God. And yet there was a time when he was just so discouraged, and he was fit to be tied. And I guess he must have thought, why should I bear this all by myself? I'm going to write a tune. And I'm going to share it so that other people who come to the temple to worship, they can know a little bit about my journey. It turned out to be such a good tune that it was included in the Bible. It's an inspired tune. Al, you may have some inspired tunes that you would like to share with us sometime. Asaph, one man's journey from discouragement to hope. So we're going to look at that today. I think we'll go through it. Never sure sometimes whether read the whole passage or just kind of read it section by section. I think we're going to read it section by section. Asaph. I like Asaph. Scholars tell us that Asaph had a signature style. You know what that means? That's like when you hear a Garth Brooks tune and nobody tells you it's a Garth Brooks tune, but you already know it's a Garth Brooks tune because he has a signature style. Apparently Asaph was like that. When you read one of his tunes, when you sang one of his songs, hey, that's an Asaph tune. I like this guy. So if you want to imagine Asaph being over here, he's in a place we'll call discouragement. And of course, he wants to go to the same place that all discouraged people want to go, a place called hope. Only to get from this place to that place, he's got to travel through some lands. And I call them rather strange lands. And we want to look at some of these lands today. And the first land was the land of despair. He found himself in the place of despair. So let's read this. Psalm 77. For the director of music, for Jeduthun of Asaph, a psalm. Here's his despair. I cried out to God for help. I cried out to God to hear me. When I was in distress, I sought the Lord. At night, I stretched out untiring hands, and I would not be comforted. Asaph knows his craft. He knows the language of lament. Do you know that there are inspired complaints in the Bible? You may have grown up thinking complaining is bad. Actually, not all complaining is bad. Some complaining is good. Our problem is we often don't know who to complain to. We complain to people who can't do anything about our problems. We don't know who to complain to. The Bible doesn't say, thou shalt not complain. The Bible says, thou shalt take thy complaints to the Almighty. Don't complain to the pastor if you haven't complained to God. Don't complain to the chairman of the elders board. Don't complain to the deacons. Don't complain to your spouse. Don't complain to your neighbors if you have not first taken it to who's really in charge. So Asaph, he got this, and he had a complaint. And his complaint had to do with the fact that he had trouble and distress in his life, but nobody seemed to be doing anything about it. He came to God, he asked for help, but far as he could tell, no help had been forthcoming. Craig Broyles, one of my favorite psalm scholars, Trinity Western, has this to say about verse 1. Take a read, and I think it beautifully suits what we find in verses 1 and 2. So Asaph has this complaint. He knows that there will be trouble in life. He just expects God to be there and to demonstrably help him out when trouble comes. And we see that he expresses his complaint with words. He's so eloquent. These worship leaders, they're just so eloquent. They find the right word for the right situation. They know how to encompass the emotion of the human drama. And he's got words, and he's also got posture. He is really getting into it. I mean, his body language is signaling that he feels distressed. His arms are up, his hands are out, he's in a posture of surrender and reliance upon God. And the emotion that percolates in his complaint is essentially, where's God? Just a little question. Where's God? Have you ever felt that way? Where's God? Did you know it's okay to feel that way? It's not a bad thing to feel that way. Godly people, people in the Bible, who sometimes found themselves painted in a corner by life, and they prayed, and they implored, and they asked God to come, and they didn't think he was coming, and so they felt like he wasn't there, and they said it. Where's God? I don't know what we would do if somebody got up to pray a prayer here at Balmoral and started complaining about the absence of God and the silence of God. That would actually be a very biblical prayer. We don't know how to lament. We don't do lament very well in the church. And my suspicion is that if we're not doing lament well in the church, we're probably not doing it very well in our prayer closets as well. So shame on us. Here we have a God who invites us, gives us freedom to come and let it all hang out, and we don't take advantage of it. And that's why so often your friends spray you with their discontent. It's because they haven't learned the godly discipline of lament. Let's learn that discipline. Where's God? So that's the first land. He's making his way from discouragement to hope, and the first place that he lands is despair. The second place that he lands, we're going to call this the land of doubt, verses 3 through 9. Let me read that. I remembered you, God, and I groaned. I meditated and my spirit grew faint. You kept my eyes from closing. I was too troubled to speak. I thought about the former days, the years of long ago. I remembered my songs in the night. My heart meditated and my spirit asked, will the Lord reject forever? Will he never show his favor again? Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Has his promise failed for all time? Has God forgotten to be merciful? Has he in anger withheld his compassion? Do you get his mood? How he feels? Well, Asaph finds himself in the land of doubt, and so he does what many of us do when we don't feel well. He retreats. He reminisces. He takes a stroll down memory lane. He goes hunting for his sweet spot. When the present isn't very sweet, you go to the past. I think we have a quote. One of my favorite German psalm scholars. This is how they describe what's going on here. See if you agree with that. What's your sweet spot? You know, in the middle of winter, and I'm shoveling my driveway for the umpteenth time. Oh, you may think I'm in Red Deer, but I'm really in Florida. I'm sitting under a palm tree. I'm reading my favorite book, Down by the Beach. It's great. It's amazing what you can do. We can retreat. We can turn to the good old days. And that's what Asaph did. He didn't think God was alive and active, and so he went to a time in his life when God was alive, when God was there, when he was answering his prayers. Only it backfired. He thought it was going to comfort him, but it only brought him pain. And so in verses 3 and 4, he says, I feel awful. I mean, when I compare what used to be with what seems to be now, ooh, it just doesn't make me feel good at well. I'm achy, I'm weak, I'm sleepless, I'm speechless. I can't get a good night's rest. This is just bugging me. And I'm to the point where I just can't talk about it. Have you ever tried to talk to somebody about a situation that's not going well and they just turn to you and say, I'm sorry, but I just can't talk about this right now. It's too heavy. It just hurts too much. Can we take this up later? That's why he felt. Because notwithstanding all of his prayers and all of his requests, he didn't seem to be getting any responses from God. Verses 5 through 9, his confidence is shaken. This is really something. I mean, when you read through these six questions, these are ultimate questions. This isn't just sort of a little bout of doubt. We all have little bouts of doubt, right? You know, it was just a bad day. I was just having a bad day. But then sometimes, and we've had friends or family members who have had such serious doubts of faith that they ended up just throwing everything over their shoulders. Well, what does it sound like to you when he says, will the Lord reject forever? Will he never show his favor again? Like these dramatic, it almost sounds like overly dramatic, over-the-top adverbs. Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Has his promise failed for all time? Has God forgotten to be merciful? Has he in his anger withheld his compassion? I think now the question that's percolating in his soul, before it was, where's God? I think now the question that is percolating in his soul is, are we done? God, are we done? Are you done with us? That's pretty serious stuff, isn't it? That's where he was, in the land of doubt. What a nasty place to be, the land of doubt. I sometimes get nervous around people who have like really big major doubts. And my son, my good postmodern son, he'll sit me down and he'll say, Dad, you got to get used to it. My generation's always doubting about stuff. He says, half my friends have major doubts about this, that, and the other thing. Better get used to it, Dad. Oh, I have trouble getting used to that. This is pretty serious stuff. So he's on his way to hope, and he's been to the land of despair, and now he's been to the land of doubt. He's wondering, are we done? Oh, I wanted to tell you about one of my sweet spots, Blue Jays. Been kind of a tough year for the Jays. I was in Toronto this summer, and I got to see them play Boston. We beat Boston. It was just so beautiful. But it really hasn't been that good a year. Early in the season, or last season perhaps, the ownership, management, they opened the purse strings and really invested some serious coin into putting together a talented team. Only thing is, I don't think we're going to make the playoffs again. You know how long it's been since we were in the playoffs? So, baseball fans, you know, when we have this sort of dramatic moment, what we do is we take a stroll down memory lane. Where do we go? What year do we go to? If you're a Jays fan, you go to what? 1992, 1993, went to the World Series, won the World Series. It was fabulous. But you know what? Sooner or later, you got to come back to 2014, and it kind of sucks. And that's kind of the experience that Asaph had. Went to a sweet spot, but he had to come back, and when he came back, he was just so distressed, and he wondered, are we done? The journey continues. The next land. I like this one a little better. This is the land of delight. Been in the land of despair, 1 and 2. Been in the land of doubt, 3 through 9. And now he's in the land of delight, 10 through 20. He is not done with memory lane yet. He is really now pressing into God. He thinks, I'm onto something. This thinking about God, this reviewing the past, this recalling what God has done and how well he has moved and how he's helped his people. I'm going to stay there for a while longer. And so now he takes his second retreat, and this one seems to be so much more promising. Makes me wonder, what was the first retreat all about? What was the first little reminiscing all about? Was that just escapist? Was that just like Terry B. Weeb in January shoveling, and he has this sort of escapist trip to Florida in his mind? Is that what that was all about, just an escapist moment? But now he is really leaning into God. He is believing that, boy, there's something about God that I don't want to miss here. And this time, it turns out to be so promising. Now there is a new tone. The tone shifts. It's like he turns a corner at verse 10. It's different. Listen to what he says. Then I thought, to this I will appeal. The years when the Most High stretched out his right hand. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your miracles of long ago. I will. All these resolves. I will not let you go. I will not forget. I will. I will consider all your works and meditate on your mighty deeds. And now, he bursts. What does he burst into? What do you call this? Your ways, verse 13, God, are holy. What's that? What's he bursting into now? What would you call that? Praise. He's bursting into praise. He was so bummed out before, and now he's bursting with praise. He says, your ways, God, are holy. God rules. This is his version of God rules. Your ways are awesome. What God is as great as our God? Our God has no competition. Our God has no peers. There's nobody who can go toe-to-toe with our God. What God is as great as our God? You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the peoples. What you do, God, you don't do in secret. What you do, you often do in the public domain. And in a moment, he's going to talk about the Exodus. The Exodus did not happen in secret. The Exodus happened in public domain. It's very interesting. When scholars have scoured the annals of Egyptian history, they have not found one little bit of information about the Exodus. And far as we can tell, they were so humiliated by it, they were so devastated by it, that they ordered their historians to rewrite history and to erase all that stuff. We don't want any of that stuff getting passed from one generation to another, because it demonstrated decisively the superiority of the God of Israel over the God of the Egyptians. And they got rid of it. They were historical revisionists. Where have we met revisionists before? You are the God who performs miracles. With your mighty arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. And then he talks about not only God who rules, but God who rescues. That's the story of the Bible. That's the story of history. God to the rescue. This story here. And if some of you came up to the microphone, you could add to that this story here. Incidents and episodes of God to the rescue in your life in little and big ways. God rules. God rescues. So he talks in verses 15 to 19 about the Exodus. I'm not going to read it. Very vivid, very poetic. He personifies. He talks about the Exodus. He talks about the wilderness. I only want to draw your attention to two points. And that is that as he describes the Exodus and the wilderness, he puts his finger on the very theme that's been bugging Asaph. What's been bugging Asaph? Asaph has been bothered by the hiddenness of God. Listen to how he describes in verse 19, the Red Sea crossing. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters. Though your footprints were what? Were not seen. We didn't see God. He was there. He was active, but he was hidden. And then in verse 20, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. It looked like Moses and Aaron were doing the leading, but Asaph says, no, it was really God. God was behind them. He was hidden. And so he puts his finger on the very theme that's been bothering Asaph, namely the hiddenness of God. And so I think there's another question that percolates to the surface of Asaph's soul. Before it was, where's God? Then it was, are we done? And now it's, could there be more? Is there more? Could there again be blessing? There was blessing in the past. Could there be blessing in the future? God ruled then. Could he rule now? God rescued then. Could he rescue again? You have to read between the lines. He doesn't come right out and say this. He doesn't even use the word hope. But he's just sort of tottering on the cusp. It's like we need one more stanza in his poem. But he doesn't. He just kind of leaves the reader hanging there. And I think with good cause. I think he wants the reader to decide for themselves. What do you think? Could it happen again? Is there more? Is the blessing of God repeatable? And so by remembering the way that God worked in the past, it evoked praise in Asaph, which began to open the door. You can just see the door starting to open. It's not quite open yet. He's not quite into the land of hope yet. It's just starting to open to hope. And we all do this. We all do this in our lives. There are times when we get down and we get discouraged and we go to our sweet spot and we think about what God did then, and then we take the hope and we transport it back to where we are today. I'm a father with adult children. Think about my children every hour of just about every day. They're not all following the Lord. Sometimes I get discouraged. Your friends, your family as well. I get discouraged. Do you know where I go? I go back to my own conversion. I go back to my own story about how God found this irreverent, self-absorbed, inattentive young boy, young man, and he found me, and he revealed himself to me, and he opened my eyes. I was blind, and I saw. And I trusted Christ, and I began following Christ. And all of a sudden, I had direction. I had meaning in my life. I didn't have it before. I was lost. I didn't have all the answers to all my questions answered, but I had a direction. And I think, you know what? If God could do that in my life, whose life couldn't he do it in? And I really believe that. And so this sort of logic works for me as well. So my friend Richard, we kind of left him hanging before. I need to come back and tie that story off. So a short time later, I got this note from my friend who was so bummed out because he was telling me about, you know, I had this Psalm 77 kind of day. And I said, what do you mean you had a Psalm 77 kind of day? And of course, I did what I asked you to do. I went and turned to Psalm 77 and I read it and I pondered it. And so I said, tell me more. Tell me more about what's happening in your life. And he said, Psalm 77, it exhibits a lot of trust despite. I love those two words side by side. Trust despite. Sometimes it's really easy to trust God. Like when the blessings are just flowing and everything is working out tickety-boo, then it's easy to trust the Lord. But then there are other moments where it's more of a trust despite. He said, not feeling down. It's like there's a new mood to my friend Richard. But sure, I'm ready for a new adventure. So far, just more inquiries. But you've got to knock to see doors open. This is an optimism. You know, there's a hopefulness that he didn't have before. I've not been bothering with those meds as I find they make me fuzzy. He didn't like the meds that his doctor had prescribed. I just thought that is so cool. I just felt like my friend Richard, he started in the land of discouragement, and now he's on the cusp of hope. And yeah, he had to go through despair and doubt, and then he's hitting these pockets of praise. It's happening all over again. And then I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could read the future with the same confidence that we can read the past? Now, I know Confucius said, and he's right, the future is very difficult to read. That is true. But we all get a chance to sort of take an attitude about the future. You know, we're in a jam, we're in a problem as individuals, as a congregation, as a nation, as a society. What if we read the future the same way as we read the past? And this was really brought home to me recently. I love this when I've got stories to tell you that just come right out of our congregation. Thank you for the way you give me these stories. So a while ago, a book that Lewis Edwards had written, A History of Balmoral Bible Chapel, was recommended to me. How many of you have read Lewis's A History of Balmoral Chapel? Not too many. We may have to get that back to the presses for another edition because there could be more demand for it. Actually, if you send Deb Taylor an email, she'll send you an electronic copy, okay? A PDF or some other file. But anyways, this is sort of, you know, the history of Balmoral Bible Chapel in, I don't know how many pages, 20, 30 pages, whatever. And it was just an amazing read. You know, the beginnings, humble beginnings, what happened in this era, what happened in this area, and so on and so forth. And as I was reading it several times, I just had to put the book down. And I just had to bask in the good things that God had done among us and through us. I thought, this is really great. And then I had another thought. And the thought was, hey, hold it, Terry, just a sec. You were here for one of those chapters. And I look back at the chapter where my name was mentioned a couple of times, you know, the 80s, early 90s. And I thought, funny thing is, you know, when I was here in the 80s and the early 90s, I didn't always feel what I felt now looking at it through, you know, the lenses of hindsight, right? Hindsight's different. When you look at life in your rearview mirror, you see things that you couldn't see at the time. And I thought, you know, when there were times when I was here in the 80s and I just didn't feel like, oh, like everything is good. You know, everything's the way that it should be, you know. Wow, we're seeing God work. Sometimes I didn't feel that. But the historian comes along and he gives you a new lens. And he brings things together in rather compact form. And all of a sudden the lights go on and you realize, yes, that was a God time. That was a God moment. What if we could read the future the same way that we read the past? Get your copy, by the way, of A History of Balmoral Bible Chapel and read it and revel in the work that God has done. Would you be surprised if our journey to hope took us through some of the strange lands encountered by Asaph? Places where we ask questions like, where's God? Is he done with us? Could there be more blessing yet to come? Or has he turned the tap off? Has there been an emergency in heaven where the blessing reservoir is now empty? Uh-oh, out of luck. Sometimes we wonder about that. Could there be more blessings yet to come? Asaph, if he were here today, I think he would say, keep pressing into God. Keep pressing into what he's already done. Keep believing he's not yet done, that there's more to come. Be an Asaph. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for these frank and honest reflections from Asaph, an ancient believer. Thank you that you accompany us in our life journey, whether they be moments of discouragement, despair, whether they be moments of praise or hope. Thank you that you are the God who offers us your journeying presence for all of life. Thank you for your work here at Balmoral in years gone by. Thank you for your work at Balmoral today. And thank you especially for what is to come. Thank you that our future depends not on us, but it depends on you. Not on our wits, but on your grace. And so we look to you and we lean into you. We pray this through Christ. Amen.